The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next. Before we air today's morning show, we want to remind you that the morning show is available also to you as a podcast with a different morning show 7 days a week. It's available on all of the major podcast platform providers such as Spotify, Google Podcast, and Apple Podcast. You need to make sure to search for The Morning Show with Greg Berg. Support for The Morning Show comes from Carthage College, home of the Aspire program, and its multifaceted approach to career preparation. The new program is designed to cultivate leadership and entrepreneurial skills while empowering each Carthage student to shape a custom career development plan from their first days on campus. Learn more about the Aspire program at carthage.edu/aspire. And we welcome you to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. The title of the book at hand is Abandoned: America's Lost Youth and the Crisis of Disconnection. The subtitle of the book, when it talks about youth, is also actually talking about young adults and about something that we are simply not talking about to the extent that my guest, Ann Kim, believes we need to. That is, there are millions of young adults who find themselves, in her words, abruptly abandoned, disconnected from the foundations of school, work, and family. And for so many of them, in a sense, life comes kind of to a screeching halt in terms of what they are able to accomplish, the progress that they are able to make. And it is really a tragic story, tragic if for no other reason than because of the whole matter of lost potential. And Ann Kim writes very, very persuasively about her concerns. She is a contributing editor to Washington Monthly and has written extensively on a number of related topics. This book, published by the New Press, is again titled Abandoned: America's Lost Youth and the Crisis of Disconnection. Ann Kim, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg, for having me. Appreciate it.
It seems to me that this book is one of those really important and exciting books in that it really does an amazing job of revealing to the rest of us an urgent problem that, in a sense, is right under our noses and yet, at least to a large extent, unacknowledged or unnoticed. Do you think that's a fair characterization of, in a sense, what this book is all about?
It is, Greg. Thank you very much for framing it that way. I do think that there is a crisis of opportunity among our nation's young people, and it's a crisis that's really hidden in plain sight. There are 4.5 million young people ages 16 to 24 who are not in school and not working. That's 11.5% of all young people in that age group. It's kind of unbelievable that there hasn't been as much national attention on the problem of what's happening with our young people up until this point.
And I think one of the things you spell out for us in the book's introduction is the fact that there are many people, many young people, for whom this is not the story at all. And probably the rest of us prefer to kind of occupy our attention with the feel-good stories of those young people who are doing well, connected with family and school and work and church and all the other means of support and encouragement. But then there are these millions and millions of young people who are not part of that, who are falling away from the American dream at this point in their lives when we imagine them embarking on life's next chapter and life's next adventure. It's probably a story that we are tempted to, in a sense, turn away from.
I think that's right. And you do hear every day about the spectacular successes of so many young people. And it's true that there are many, many young people who are doing well. But I think we're also seeing this gigantic divergence in the young people who are doing very well and the young people who are doing not. And the reason for that is that the runway to adulthood is a lot longer than it used to be. If you look back a generation ago, you graduated from high school, you finished the school, and you could probably get a job. And by the time you were in your early 20s, you were married and maybe had kids of your own. Today, that runway to adulthood is a lot longer. People are needing to get more education, better education, the right kind of education, more expensive education. And they're staying more connected to their family than they were in the past. And I'm talking about, you know, NPR listeners, to be precise. One out of three young people up to age 24, according to the Federal Reserve, gets some sort of help from mom and dad. And the typical family can now expect to spend about $50,000 investing in a young adult up to age 30. But what about those young people who do not have the benefit of that extended support from mom and dad, who don't have the basement to come home to if something goes wrong, who can't afford to pay for college, or who are in the foster care system, or who are ensnared in the criminal justice system at a young age? There's just a vast and growing gulf between the haves and the have-nots among young adults that I think is really driving inequality in a way that hasn't been appreciated so far. And a lot of those failures are of public policy in driving that wedge between the young adults who are succeeding and who are not, and those who are not.
It's probably important at this point in time to say that this sense of disconnection and abandonment that many of these young adults are feeling, in some cases at least, is not because their families don't love them, or are not interested in them, or wouldn't support them if they possibly could. But we're talking about young people from families with parents who are not in a position to support them and to guide them into adulthood in the way that that many other Americans are. Is that what we're talking about here?
Yes, we are definitely also talking about that as well. And that's something I think you can see in Wisconsin. There is a fantastic nonprofit called the Measure of America Project that's run by the Social Science Research Council, and they have a map that shows county by county what the disconnection rates are for young people. And if you look at Wisconsin, you see just wide variation in who is disconnected and where, and exactly what you're talking about, Greg. When you go to the more rural parts of the state, you know, and if you go into places like, well, so Kenosha County is actually not bad as far as disconnection. It's 11.6% disconnection rate, which is right on the national average. But if you go into Milwaukee, it gets a little bit worse. And then if you go into the central parts of the state, the rates get even higher. Jackson County, Wisconsin, for example, 20.7% of young people are neither in school nor working. That's one in five. And I'm sure that a lot of this has to do with lack of access to opportunity. Are there jobs in those communities? Is there a good community college or a college that's within reach? Many, many parents want the best for the young adults, but these structural barriers sometimes stand in the way. One of the places I visited when I was writing the book was a community in Southwest Virginia, which had been a manufacturing hub. It was also a place where tobacco had been a core product for key crop for many decades. All that went away in the early 90s, and the nearest college was nearly an hour away, and young people there really felt trapped, and their parents could not help them. Well-meaning as they were, there were no jobs there, and there were no educational opportunities there. So it's these structural barriers that also need to be fixed, as well as these other problems we have with our child welfare system and criminal justice system. Those three things together, along with an educational system that maybe doesn't always connect young people, make that connection between high school and college and high school and career that kind of need to be fixed here to ensure that young people get the start they need in life.
We're speaking with Ann Kim, and we're talking about her book, Abandoned, America's Lost Youth and the Crisis of Disconnection. I was a little bit taken aback as you were describing this in the book's introduction by these words. Often the systems and institutions that are supposed to help these young people have instead sabotaged their chances of success, exacerbating the hardships they already face. I wasn't prepared to read those words, because up until that point in the introduction, what you've mostly talked about are maybe systems that are not in place or adequately in place to give support to those young adults that so desperately need that help. But it seems to me that at this point in the book, you're saying something that goes a step further in indicting the status quo. How is it that these systems and institutions are actually hurting these young adults rather than helping them? And what institutions and systems are we talking about here?
Yes, I think the primary culprit here, for instance, might be the child welfare system, the foster care system. And the purpose of the child welfare system is to protect children from neglect and abuse. But as it turns out, the state is a terrible parent, as I say in the book. When you look at what happens with young people who are forced to stay within the system, who aren't adopted, and who are quote-unquote aged out, the outcomes are absolutely horrific. What happens to these young people is that it's like a spigot that turns off. The day they turn 18 or the day they turn 21 in some states, the supports abruptly end. Most states do not offer, for instance, discounted or free college tuition if any of these kids want to go on to higher education. And remind you, these are children who don't have parents to fall back on. So what happens is that less than 10% end up with a two-year or four-year degree. One out of three ends up homeless. One out of three ends up incarcerated. Fewer than half end up with a job of any kind by the time that they're age 26. The system is not working for foster care youth at all. And then we're talking about 500,000 kids at any time in the child welfare system and about 20,000 young people who age out every year. And that's 20,000 young people whose potential may be lost because of a system that hasn't adequately prepared them to survive on their own. That, I think, is the number one tragedy of what's happening with young adults as far as these kinds of systems are concerned. Criminal justice system is another one. You know, if you're a juvenile and the purpose of the justice system is to rehabilitate you, perhaps, but if you are in an adult prison or an adult jail, which happens all too often to young adults, you are there in the prime years of your young adulthood with no educational opportunities, and you are at high risk of assault, of violence. Bureau of Justice, I'm sorry, the Justice Department says about 1 in 10 young people in incarceration are subject to sexual assault in some way. And within 2 to 3 years, 80% of these young people are going to be reoffending. So again, we have blasted the chances of a young person who had the potential to set things right and get a second chance. Instead, what we're doing is ensuring that the young person will not succeed.
Can you explain how such a thing is possible? I mean, can you explain how the system got created in such a way that it would, in a sense, end with this, what you term as kind of utter abandonment of those who have been part of that system? I mean, has it always been so? And how could such a thing be possible? How could such a thing be allowed to happen?
Yes, I think there are a couple things going on here. The first is as I alluded to before, this phenomenon of young adulthood, what sociologist Jeffrey Arnett calls emerging adulthood, is relatively new. You know, it's only been in the last generation or so that we really thought about young adulthood as kind of a distinct developmental phase where you do have more growing up to do. All the public programs, most of them were put into place when 18, you know, you got drafted when you were 18. You know, high school ended when you're 18. If you get a job when you're 18, there's a different conception when we put a lot of these programs in place for when adulthood began that's evolved and public policy hasn't caught up. The second thing that's gone on is that there is a lot of negative stereotyping, I'm afraid to say, around who young people are who get in trouble. There is, I think, a stereotype about the 20-year-old guy who is maybe in the basement of the parent's house just playing video games and not getting out there and trying to find a job, or worse yet, racialized stereotypes about, you know, young adults who are out there causing trouble, and it's about personal responsibility or poor choices or, you know, other misperceptions, I think, that put the onus of the blame on the young adult for what's happened versus looking at what their surroundings are. A phrase I heard an awful lot during the research of this book is, you know, you'll be what you see. And if you don't see opportunity around you, if you don't have people around you who are going to connect you to jobs or other opportunities or open your eyes, you're very limited in what is possible for you. So I think it's a combination of where public policy was and still is, negative stereotypes about who young people are and what they aspire to. This other thing that I really learned in the research of this book, young people really want to work hard, and they really have big dreams for themselves. They are nothing like some of these very harmful negative stereotypes that some people may have about who low-income young people might be. And that's one of the things that I'm hoping that this book will change, is to cast a new light on the hopes and aspirations and the struggles,
right,
the barriers that are standing in the way.
And the fact that we need to focus on this part of a person's life more than we have up until now, that the same attention that we have given to, for instance, recognizing the significance of early childhood in one's development, we need to be focusing on this moment in a person's life with just as much care and concern. And until now, we've tended to just kind of take it for granted that by that point, one doesn't need special help, special encouragement, but some people do.
Yes, no, that's right. And that's a great point about early childhood. I think one of the triumphs of public policy in recent years has been this recognition that early childhood really matters. And we all know that as middle-class, upper-middle-class parents who got the Baby Einstein toys and all of these things. And we have public programs like Head Start and early preschool. But what brain science has come to realize over the last 20 years, neuroscientists have discovered, is that that period between 16 to 25, there's just as much developmentally going on physiologically as there is in early childhood. The brain is still very plastic. So between 16 and 25 is when these very critical connections form between the frontal lobes of your brain and the rest of you. So parents of teenagers who see their kids as impulsive, not making rational decisions, acting out, there's a reason for that. Their brains physiologically are not finished, and they're not done until 25. So that tells you a lot, I think, about how kids in that age range need second chances. They can learn. There is just huge potential for development in there, and we can't let those years go to waste. Unfortunately, that's exactly what we're doing for a lot of kids.
We're speaking with Ann Kim about her book, Abandoned, America's Lost Youth and the Crisis of Disconnection. Before we move on to some other specifics, I wanted to give you a chance to talk about the way in which young adulthood plays out for so many young adults very differently than it once did. And in particular, the fact that In your words, many young people are increasingly taking zigzag paths toward their adult selves. Explain some of the ways in which this is most true, and the ways in which this is really important for us to understand in coming to grips with some of these concerns that you raise in your book.
Yes, this plays a lot into what I was alluding to before about the divergence in adult, young adult experiences. It's not so straightforward anymore for a young adult to succeed. A lot of people switch majors. You have to have an internship. You get that first job, and maybe it's not such a great job. You get a second one. You gotta go back home and live in your parents' basement for a little bit to figure it out. You go to graduate school. You have one or two or three or more failed relationships. Young adulthood, and again, Jeffrey Arnett, whom I mentioned before, has really chronicled kind of the trials and failures that have come to characterize young adulthood before you finally succeed. And in the past, we've called this failure to launch, but now it's become recognized as part of this growing up process. The lucky ones are the ones who have the parents, the mentors, the coaches, the supervisors, the intern coordinators to support the young adult as they make their way, create connections for them, mentor them, and allow them to fail. So we have infantilized, in a lot of ways, the 22-year-old person. They're, we consider them babies now. But when you're talking about low-income young adults, we still adultify them. You know, in some states, you can be 10 and sent to an adult prison. A lot of states still consider someone who's 16 to be an adult. We have a double standard for how we treat young adults depending upon who they are, where they are, and, you know, what color they are. So that divergence in the opportunities available to young adults is really driving some significant inequality, I think, and allowing privileged young adults to cement their advantages in such a way that forces others to fall further and further behind. But society as a whole is going to end up having to pay for disconnected young adults who are disconnected 10 years later. If we don't create new opportunities and modernize some of our systems so that all young adults have at least a shot or at least a second chance if they mess up along the way to set themselves straight.
I would love to have you be a little more specific when it comes to the way in which, first of all, our current public policy favors the affluent. In your words, public policy right now heavily favors the advancement of affluent young adults by subsidizing the ability of their parents to swaddle them in every advantage. How does our current public policy do that?
Sure. You just look at our tax code, for instance, you know, and the multiple people. Yes, college is absolutely unaffordable. It's expensive. But if you look at our tax code, there are an awful lot of tax breaks for middle-class and upper-middle-class people to be able to save for their kids' college education. So 529 accounts are a great example of that. Fantastic program if you can afford it, but more than 90% of the benefits of 529s go to families earning over $100,000 a year. That's just one example of the ways in which tax subsidies are skewered to the upper-middle-class. Better schools are available if you are living in a better neighborhood. You know, that is a zip code specific, neighborhood specific advantage that upper middle class families can take advantage of. There are many advantages like that. Our social capital networks, the people whom you know, there are many hidden advantages that upper middle class and middle class young people can take advantage of that are invisible in a lot of ways, but are not available to younger folks who are not in the same circumstances.
And the other half of this, of course, is you see our current public policy as, in your words, abandoning lower-income young adults and accelerating the divergence. You go on to say government seems all too eager to shed its responsibilities toward vulnerable young people. Again, I would love to have you kind of paint with some specifics there in terms of how this currently occurs.
The most obvious example are the young people aging out of foster care, where the young person is literally set out on the street in a lot of situations the day they turn 18 or the day they're 21. We have free education up until high school. We don't have ways to make higher education more affordable to people who truly affordable, genuinely affordable to people who don't have the means to go there themselves. There are 41 million Americans, according to the Urban Institute, who live in what are called rural higher education deserts. They're more than half an hour away from any sort of higher educational opportunity. Why is that? Public policy should be doing something to make higher education available to everyone, because it has become so important, if you're going to have a living wage job, to get some sort of post-secondary credential, even if it's not a four-year degree, a certificate, something, a trade. We're failing our young people there. In terms of the criminal justice system, it's too many young people who are just tossing them into a jail cell and throwing away the key. No education, no training when they come out, no real care and feeding of returning offenders into society. We give up, I think, on far too many young people the minute they've made a single mistake. And there's just simply not enough investment at all being made in programs that can connect young people back to school and work if they have been disconnected in some way, or to keep young people connected from their high school years through a well-paying college, a well-paying career, and ensuring that that connection is cemented by the time that they are 24 years old. So I think this lack of investment is probably the single biggest failing as far as neglect of this population. We invest very few dollars, all told, when you look at the totality of programs that are geared toward young people 16 to 24.
I must say that of the many surprises in your book, I was especially surprised to read young people in rural areas are more likely to be disconnected than young people in cities. I mean, that just kind of flies in the face of at least some of the assumptions that we make about rural America, that rural America is a part of the country where, you know, you might not have fancy stores, or maybe not that many stores at all, and it may be lacking in certain kinds of opportunities, but there is at least this sense of close connection between people. And what you're saying here is that, in fact, that is not always the case at all, at least for young adults who find themselves caught in this particular situation. Help us understand how this can be true, and how it, in a sense, flies in the face of some of the rose-colored glass perspective we might have about the nature of rural America in the year 2020.
Yes, that is one of the surprising findings about who is disconnected and where. About one in five young adults living in rural America is disconnected, and the national average is one in nine. So it's close to double the rate. And we're talking about connection in two different senses here. You're right, Greg, that you might have very close-knit rural communities. But when you're talking about connection to school and to work and to economic opportunity, it simply may not exist. I was speaking with the superintendent of schools in Forest County, Pennsylvania, which is a rural county deep in western Pennsylvania in the Allegheny Mountains. And they don't have a lot going on. The lumber industry doesn't really use that many workers anymore than it used to a couple generations ago. The young people who can get out, and they stay out. The young people who come back are the ones who tried to make a go of it at college in the city. The nearest college is more than an hour away. But the culture shock, the academic challenges, other things that are going on bring them back home. And then the options are very limited. So you always hear that no person is an island, but that's actually not true in some parts of rural America, where there simply isn't the industry and the opportunity available to give a young person opportunities to get ahead. So you'll find in a lot of rural America now, the population is declining because young people are leaving and the ones who are left are the ones who are falling behind. That is what's driving this disconnect, the higher rates of disconnection among rural youth.
Right. I really appreciated a point you make in the third chapter of the book, which is opens the section of the book called Drifting, Avenues to Disconnection. This is such an important point. You write, because the virtual world has no geographic boundaries, it is easy to believe that the real world, too, presents an equivalently generous bounty of possibilities. In other words, in a world where one sits in front of your laptop and with a couple of clicks you are visiting the Library of Congress or shopping on Amazon or doing any number of things, it's like the whole world flows into our fingertips. And that, in a sense, rewrites our expectations about the world and what is possible for people, the opportunities that we assume everybody has in such a world where we are all connected. And you're telling us that's simply not the case, and that for certain young adults, this is not part of their lives, and they do not have access to this kind of limitless world that the rest of us very much take for granted. Tell us more about that and exactly why some of these young adults are left behind in this respect.
Yes, that's one of the ironies of modern life. In one sense, in a technological sense, we are more connected than ever before. But there's an enormous amount of personal disconnection that's going on as well. And in other ways, every one of us is more isolated than ever before. And it's very true. When I'm talking about the disconnection here, I'm talking about the disconnection with mentors, teachers, bosses. There's a very famous study that was done by a researcher named Mark Granovetter back in 1973, and he was talking about the difference between strong ties, what he called strong ties, and weak ties. Strong ties are the kinds of bonds that you have with your family and friends, and weak ties are what he called acquaintances, friends of friends. And he was looking at it from a pure economic perspective. What he found was that you are actually much more likely to get a job from a friend of a friend than from a family member or close friend. So the title of his paper was called The Strength of Weak Ties. And the reason for that is because the weak ties are bridges to opportunity. They're bridges to networks that you do not currently have access to. Young people who aren't able to get their foot in the door with that internship or that first good job, or who has a mentor or coach with access to these other opportunities, truly are not connected in a very real sense, because they are not connected to any of these networks of opportunity that other young people have. So even, you know, the social, if you're a member of LinkedIn, it tells you who your connections are, and then it tells you other people who are outside of your connections who are within one of your connections. It's mapped that for you. You can kind of see the strength of your own weak ties by exploring your own network. Now, if you're a young person who's never had a job, who can't get a job, how do you even get your foot in the door into the kind of vast networking opportunity that LinkedIn offers, or the informal networks that you might get if you belong to, say, if you belong to a soccer team and your parents meet other parents and they connect you and you get that summer job? We take for granted these informal connections that are way more important than the kind of shallow connectivity that you get from surfing the net and seeing what's out there in the world. That's the distinction I'm trying to make.
Right. You spell out the this notion of the opportunity desert, that is, those places where there are very, very few opportunities, especially for these vulnerable young adults, in both rural America and in urban America as well, including sometimes the sort of strange story of places that we think of as doing well in so many respects, but which will have pockets in which the scenario is exactly the opposite. You cite Baltimore, Maryland as a really good example of that.
Yes, there is a particular neighborhood called Sandtown in the heart of Baltimore that was doing extraordinarily well in the middle half of the last century, 20th century, up until the late 60s, when there was a wave of rioting and things just really fell apart and haven't come back together since. I was just driving through Sandtown the other day to check in on some of the folks that are in the book. There's block after block after block of boarded up townhomes. Beautiful, historic townhomes, but plywood on the walls, plywood on the doors, people kind of standing around street corners, maybe a couple cars on the street, really? And this is in the heart of Baltimore. That is allegedly doing very well, and parts of it are doing extraordinarily well. Under Armour is there. There's an Amazon facility nearby. Ostensibly, there are jobs. But the infrastructure of the city is such that if you're living in Sandtown, you can't get to those. You can't get to those places. Place matters so much. That's one of the themes that I come back to again and again in the book. Zip code really matters. Where you live really makes a difference in the opportunities available to you. And there's a lot of research that's come out on that. There's a couple of maps in the book that. And organizations have generated around the access to opportunity. And parts of the South and in the middle of the country are simply not doing as well as the rest of the country. And I think the last election was a wake-up call in terms of the consequences of this kind of regional inequality and the impact it has on our social fabric and our politics. And I suspect it's an issue that's going to come up again in this election. So this has real consequences. The young people, what's happening with them, are canary in the coal mine as far as these larger forces that have the real potential to tear the country apart if we don't do something about it now.
I want to mention that your book includes not only observations of a more general nature about what's going on in our country, but also includes many very specific personal stories of certain young adults who find themselves caught in this sad scenario of abandonment in one way or another. I wonder if you could just say a word about how you connected with these particular young adults and why you thought it was important that your book include this element of very personal individual stories.
I was fortunate to connect with a number of nonprofits who are doing just incredible work with young adults and who are, for the most part, unheralded, unsung, and underfunded. And they opened their doors to me and allowed, and the young people were incredibly generous with me in sharing their stories. I felt it was very important to include young people's stories in this book because there is so much negativity and misperception about who young people are who are struggling and why they struggle, and to push back again on this myth that it's all about personal responsibility and poor life choices and whatever other stereotypes people might have in their head. I really wanted to push back against that and say, no, you know, these are young people who are really trying, but there are certain barriers that they cannot get rid of on their own because they're only 18 or 19 or 20 and they cannot fight a system that's stacked against them in some way. It's also important to note, I think, that there are some young people in there who are success stories, young people who've fought the odds and really done well. And I've updated what's going on with some of the young people who are in the book. And I'm happy to say that a number of them have gone on to do extraordinary things. You know, made a foothold in the middle class and are continuing to succeed. Others, not so fortunate, unfortunately. And that is a tragedy.
Right. I want to make sure that we are able to spend at least a couple of minutes talking about part three of your book, which is titled Anchored, Paths to Reconnection, in which you spell out a number of instances and examples of where a real difference is made with some success stories, with programs that seem designed to meet this crisis that you describe so vividly in your book. Tell our listeners about a couple of the most gratifying success stories that are an encouraging sign to us that meaningful progress can be made on this.
Yes, so I will briefly mention two. The first is what's called a transitional housing program that's in Fairfax County, Virginia, called Second Story. And it is essentially a homeless shelter for young moms. And the woman I talk about in the book, her name is Carla. She had become pregnant around age 15, kicked out of her house, and had nowhere to go. Second Story took her in, and they became her surrogate family for 4 years. They gave her a place to stay. They gave her counseling, taught her to become a good mom, hooked her up with job training, got her re-enrolled in school. By the time I had spoken to her, and they helped her save money, so by the time I had spoken to her, she was well on her way. She had saved enough money with the help of this program to put a down payment down in a condo where she was living. She was working as a defense contractor in Fairfax County with her boyfriend and her two little boys. And she had just really, and best of all, she had managed to reconnect with her family and reconcile with them. None of this would have happened without the support of Second Story, which is the only homeless shelter for teenagers and young adults left in Fairfax County because of the funding constrictions there. But it tells you what's possible when you have an environment with caring adults and enough support to turn someone's life around. The second program I'll mention, because there is a branch of this in Wisconsin, is National Guard Challenge. This is just a phenomenal program that's undergone multiple national evaluations. It takes young adults who are high school dropouts and puts them in a residential setting as cadets. So they're there for a few months at a time to finish getting their high school education, get some job training as well. And what happens there is just this real top-to-bottom, 24/7 reorientation. The young adults who are there end up with a lot of camaraderie around their fellow cadets. They form deep relationships with their mentors. They're plucked out of the environment they came from and into a new one that's supportive and that opens their eyes to what's possible. Wisconsin has the Wisconsin Challenge Academy, and it's part of the National Guard. This is actually funded by the Department of Defense and is available in, I believe, close to 40 states at this point. But again, underfunded, it's not available in every state, it's not available everywhere, and the programs are still relatively small. But it's something that's really worth supporting because it has such potential to turn around the lives of young people who are really, who may have hit bottom, but even, every young person is redeemable.
To finish out, I really think it would make sense for us to give you a chance to spell out what you share with us in chapter 14 of your book, Seven Steps for Ending Disconnection. I really like these very, very much and want to give you the opportunity to spell them out for our listeners who then can read your book and read more about what is behind these seven steps.
Yes, thank you very, very much. And I tried very hard to go at this from a bipartisan lens. This is not a partisan issue, the future of our young people. And so the seven steps, and I won't go into all of them, are intended with a view toward being cost-effective, practical, and having maximum impact. Number one is simply to count the number of young people who are out of school and out of work. We don't do that right now. If it doesn't get measured, it doesn't matter, is the old adage, and it's very true here. The only reason we know that there are so many disconnected young adults is because of the Social Science Research Council and other organizations that try pouring through Census Bureau data to figure out the scope of this problem. In the United Kingdom, they have a percentage, they have a measure called NEETS, not in employment, education, or training. And every month, they'll put out a report that says, hey, the percentage of young adults who are NEET is this. And that focuses public policy and resources on the problem to solve it. We need to do the same thing. We're about to have the 2020 census, it would be a relatively small matter to ask this question so we have a handle on the scope of the problem and then we begin to focus on it in a national way. A second common sense thing to do is simply to invest more in some of the programs that we know work. And yes, we're talking about more money, but it's going to save money down the line. If we invest a few thousand dollars now, one study estimated that the total social cost of someone who is disconnected could be as high as $700,000 down the line if that person stays disconnected because of incarceration costs or welfare costs and the loss of tax dollars because that person is not working. Even just those two things can make a gigantic difference. And then one third thing that I will mention very briefly is the need for companies to step up and offer more internships, more apprenticeship programs, more work opportunity programs, and begin to see young people as an investment. Very easy for companies to say, I want to take a person who's already got the experience. But again, that's a very short-sighted way to think about hiring because they're going to have not enough people to hire from in the future if they don't invest in young people now. Take a few. If they invest in a young person, I bet you you're going to have a very loyal worker who's still there 5 or 6 years from now if you make that initial step.
And I like the rest of your list. Bring opportunity everywhere. Link schools to jobs and careers. Break the pipeline to disconnection from the foster care and justice system. Listen to young people. And remember what is at stake with this pressing concern and issue. The book is really fascinating, start to finish. Again, it's titled Abandoned, America's Lost Youth and the Crisis of Disconnection. It is a book that explores this problem thoroughly, but also lays out some reasons for hope if we can get behind some of these issues and address them in a meaningful way. The book is published by The New Press, the author, Ann Kim. Ann Kim, thank you so much for writing this important book, and thank you for being part of the morning show today. I was honored to speak with you.
Thank you so much for having me, Greg. I really was privileged as well.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, we're going to be previewing for you the latest production of the Lakeside Players of Kenosha, a really interesting parody called Death of a Streetcar Named Virginia Woolf. It's actually kind of a delightful mishmash of several different classic works, and we'll be talking to three of their cast members tomorrow. Also tomorrow, Alvaro Garcia, who is the orchestra conductor at the University of Wisconsin Parkside, and with him Rachel Velvicus, a French horn virtuoso and a Kenosha native, who is back in town as artist in residence at UW Parkside, and she's going to be performing with the orchestra in a concert this weekend. Next week, a number of different and interesting interviews, including one with best-selling author James Brown and an incredible book called Apology to a Young Addict, a memoir. Also, Steve Musenden will be joining us next week from the Racine Literacy Council, and we'll talk to the co-authors of a book called Hollywood, Her Story, a fascinating history of women in the film industry. Support for The Morning Show comes from Carthage College, home of the Aspire program, and its multifaceted approach to career preparation. The new program is designed to cultivate leadership and entrepreneurial skills while empowering each Carthage student to shape a custom career development plan from their first days on campus. Learn more about the Aspire program at carthage.edu/aspire. Interestingly, our forecast